You might recall, dear listeners, I described a scene in Adelaide at the last Festival of Ideas, which was dedicated to Paul Davies, that I'm sitting on stage with the good professor, and he suddenly changed the subject from the usual big questions to the big C, to Jimmy Dancer, and went on to shock and scandalise, I think, members of the audience, just as he's gone on to shock a great many members of what could be called the cancer industry. He's written over 20 books, as you know. He's tackled those big questions in science and philosophy. He won the Templeton Prize for Science and Religion. But he's now got a new role at the Centre for Convergence of Physical Science and Cancer Biology at Arizona State University. And he's been saying the most outrageous things about cancer, and he's under counterattack. But that's predictable, isn't it, Paul? You're not that upset by being attacked by members of the industry.
I was profiled in the journal Nature under the title of The Disruptor, which I think rather well describes my approach to science.
Well, you were asked to have a look at cancer. You said, I know bugger all about it. And your recruiter said, that makes you the perfect person.
Absolutely right. I got into this game about 9 years ago now on the strength of a phone call from the then deputy director of the National Cancer Institute in the United States, Anna Barker. And she said, well, you don't know me, but I know about your Beyond Center for Fundamental Concepts in Science at Arizona State University. You've set this up to examine fundamental problems across all of the sciences. Can you help with cancer? And I said, well, I'm afraid I don't know anything about cancer. And she said, well, that's perfect. It doesn't matter at all. But she was impressed by the fact that physicists, and I'm trained as a physicist, are good at tackling complex, deep problems. And she said, you figured out everything from the inside of the atom to the outer reaches of the universe. Can you help us sort out cancer?
You've attacked cancer scientists for not asking the big question, what is cancer for?
Right. I think
you say they know nothing about evolution.
Well, to say they know nothing is, of course,
well, they hinted they know nothing.
I have certainly talked to cancer biologists who say they never think about evolution. So that is true. It doesn't figure much. And right in the early stages, the National Cancer Institute, this isn't me, the National Cancer Institute said one of the big problems with cancer research is it's dominated by cell biologists and we don't have enough evolutionary biologists. Nobody's asking questions about evolution. And so I took that advice seriously and I tried to combine my new understanding of cancer as a biological phenomenon with my background in physics and astrobiology and looking at the great sweep of cosmic and terrestrial history and asking where does cancer fit into this story of life.
You're working with someone from the ANU, I understand.
Charlie Lineweaver, I'm sure that you know him. And so he's another iconoclastic figure. He's a cosmologist and physicist by training but got interested in the subject of cancer. And the two of us put our heads together and we came up with what we think is an alternative approach, not because we've got any new facts. We're theoreticians. We look at the existing facts about cancer and try to connect the dots together in a novel way, which is what I was told to do, what I was paid to do by the National Cancer Institute. So I'm not going to apologize for it.
It's arguable that your two closest friends here at Radio National, Robin Williams and myself, are intensely interested in this because we both have the same identical cancer.
Right, I understand that.
And I read with concern that you talk about trillions being invested in cancer research, but the mortality rate's hardly improving. Can that be right?
Right, this is the truly shocking statistic that the National Cancer Institute, this is not my statistics, the National Cancer Institute keep beating us over the head with that, 44 years since President Richard Nixon formally declared war on cancer and said it would be cracked within 5 years or so, the mortality rates have hardly changed. That all these miracle drugs that we read about, the word cancer breakthrough is there almost every day somewhere in news media. They only add up to life prolongation on average by a period of weeks, months at most, not years.
I'm fascinated to recall that Nixon declared war on cancer. Americans love declaring war on, well, they don't officially declare wars in wars now, but they declare wars on drugs and wars on terror, and they all seem to be lacking in efficacy. But I would have thought, simply from my exchanges, my experiences with any number of hospitals and specialists, that in some areas things have improved.
Yes. Yes. And of course, I'm talking average figures, and there are one or two conspicuous successes in cancer treatment, with childhood leukemia being a very obvious one. But even more, there have been great successes in cancer prevention. Now, it's not a very sexy subject. You don't get a Nobel Prize for coming out with a good health campaign. But we all know that slip, slap, slop, if we're allowed to talk about that these days.
My baby. I did that one. Yeah.
Stay out of the sun, don't breathe asbestos, but above all, stop smoking. And increasingly, don't get overweight and don't drink too much alcohol. All of these have a big impact on cancer statistics. But the NCI just cut its budget for cancer prevention from 11% to 6%. So they're not really putting much effort into it, because everybody is, under the lure of the cure. They want a general purpose pill to make all cancers go away.
The lure of the cure. You talk about the contract of the body and say cancer is a cheat.
Yes. So when you think about it, cancer is a disease of bodies, seems obvious. But bodies haven't always been around in the great story of life. In fact, they're a rather recent phenomenon. They date from only about a billion years or so ago. Life on Earth goes back about 4 billion years. So most of that time, it was single-celled. And single-celled organisms like bacteria have just one imperative: replicate, replicate, replicate. They're, in effect, immortal. Each one just splits in two. But multicelled life has a very different logic. So sometime, many times actually, between 1.5 and 1 billion years ago, communities of cells got together and obviously made a collective decision, vote or something, in outsourcing their immortality to specialised cells like sperm and egg cells, the so-called germ cells. And the cells of the body which service those germ cells, their part of the contract was to eventually commit suicide. It's called apoptosis, programmed cell death. So the trade-off was this, that the heavy lifting of carrying the genes into the next generation would be done by the germ cells. The other cells would accept as their part of the contract that they would eventually commit suicide. Now, that's obviously open to cheating. Whenever you have a community, whether it's an ant colony or it's a human community, there's always that possibility of one of the individuals availing themselves of the benefits of the community, but not paying.
Don't tell me this happens with termites or ants, does it?
I think they're a bit more disciplined than human beings. But
Tim Flannery would certainly suggest that.
And so what's happening with cancer is that there's a breakdown of that contract. To police the contract, the way it's done in human societies, we have police forces and governments and so on, regulatory control. Well, the body has regulatory control, and it's evolved more and more sophistication over the millions of years since this whole story began. And if something breaks down in that regulatory control, there's, the inner selfish cell, the inner almost like bacterium in a protozoan that will burst out and go back to the selfish old ways.
One assumes that the figures on dementia are becoming ever more alarming because we're living rather longer than we used to, and what was deemed to be faint eccentricity in a Wodehouse novel, is now a universal problem as we linger on. Is that also one of the reasons that we have more cancer, that we're simply living longer?
Yes, that's right. So on the one hand, we're not making much progress in getting rid of, I'd hate to use this word cure because I think it's very misleading, controlling or managing cancer, not very good at that. But on the other hand, people are living longer, and so more people are getting cancer. So the statistics look worse and worse every year. Cancer is now, in effect, the major killer in most countries around the world. And the burden on healthcare is enormous because the fancy anti-cancer drugs we've been talking about don't come cheap. Typically, a course of anti-cancer drugs might be $100,000 a year, and some of them are getting even more expensive. And now with people wanting multi-drug cocktails and customized or personalized medicine, that is all the rage, it's going to get ever more expensive. So we've got more people wanting it and more expensive drugs. And what we're doing is really making the best of a bad job. And it is a bad job because these drugs are not extending life by years and years and years, which is what was originally hoped, but with one or two exceptions, just by a few weeks or months.
That is shattering news for most people who are led to believe that they can linger on against all the odds for very long periods.
I'm afraid the media has a lot to blame for this. This sort of relentlessly upbeat reporting of what are really minor so-called breakthroughs at the forefront of science. And a lot of these, of course, are based on either very small clinical trials or experiments with mice. There's a lot of dead mice in this game. And to translate this into clinical practice might take years or decades.
Now, when you're not telling cancer scientists that they're on the wrong track and they're pig ignorant of evolution, what are you suggesting? What are you recommending to them? How should the research change?
Right. So the first thing I should say is that, of course, I have no authority to talk about clinical practice. It's not my job to tell the clinician how to treat the disease. It is my job, though, to say that we won't get on top of this cancer problem if we don't understand it as a biological phenomenon. That on the one hand, you can treat it as a disease to be cured, and that's the standard approach. On the other hand, you can stand back and say, well, what is it? What is this thing called cancer? How do we understand it? Can we come up with a proper conceptual framework that relates cancer to the story of life on Earth, as I've been briefly outlining? And if we understand it then as a biological phenomenon, think about how best to tackle it. And the first thing is we've got to get away from this idea of the pill that makes cancer disappear. We don't need to do that. All we need to do is to control the cancer, to stop it spreading, or if it spreads, try to contain the secondary tumours for a longer period than we've done so far. And the one thing that people fail to realise is that when people present with clinical symptoms, we say, well, they have cancer, as if they didn't have it before. But people of our age are riddled with cancer. The body's dealing with these cancers all the time without us ever knowing about it. So tiny individual cancer cells or
So you're sitting here looking incredibly, almost unnaturally healthy, but you, in fact, have cancers ticking away inside.
Absolutely. And the point is that the body copes with it. It's part of the regulatory apparatus that these small tumours will appear. They will sometimes vanish. They'll often be stabilized, or individual cancer cells will be held in check in the body. And experiments that have been done, particularly by Mina Bissell at Berkeley, demonstrate very clearly that if you put cancer cells in healthy tissues, they will be stabilized and present what we call a normal phenotype, even though genotypically they are cancer cells. So we know that the tissues of the body and the immune system hold cancer in check. And it's doing it all the time. We don't notice it going on. We only notice when something goes wrong.
So initially, in an evolutionary sense, cancer cells had a function, and an important one.
Yes, because, and this is where our research is leading at the moment. This is really fascinating. So this subject, although it's a human tragedy from the scientific point of view, is deeply fascinating. What we predicted all along is that when you look at the genes which are responsible for cancer, and you ask, how old are those genes? How far back in history do they date? And we predicted they would be very ancient. Turns out that that's correct. But you can also ask, well, what do those genes do? What are they for? Because if they're just a nuisance, just cause cancer, why can't they be eliminated? Why didn't natural selection get rid of them? And it turns out that the key genes that drive cancer, as we have discovered in the last 6 months, are the same genes which drive adaptive evolution in bacteria and other single-celled organisms. And adaptive evolution amounts to this, that you're sitting quite nicely. Here you've got these bacteria sitting in some little niche, getting on quite well, and then something changes. What are they going to do? They're starving, or they're being challenged in some way. There's some sort of external stress. They have the ability to turn up their evolutionary rate and evolve out of crisis. And that's a very, very fundamental modality of all biology, going back probably to the dawn of life, 4 billion years. And that's what cancer is doing. That's what the cancer genes are doing.
Let's go back to preventive techniques. You mentioned slip, slap, slop. I also worked with the wonderful Nigel Gray on anti-smoking campaigns. And in many ways, it was the Anti-Cancer Council in Victoria that led the world in political strategies, such as increasing the price of cigarettes by orders of magnitude. Has the Great War on Smoking, partially successful in the Western world, I would have thought, and totally unsuccessful everywhere else, has it reduced the incidence of lung cancer?
It has for men, yes. Not yet shown up for women. It's an interesting thing, because it's been my impression over the last 20 years that of the few people I know that are left smoking, it tends to be women that do it, not men. And so there's a very definite turnover, and I'm talking US statistics at the moment, but very definite turnover in cancer incidence among lung cancer incidence among males. It's not just lung cancer that smoking gives you. It gives you all sorts of cancer, but lung cancer is the one that you most notice.
I know people who have never smoked who get lung cancer, there's obviously other causal agents.
And that's the thing. See, it's not like physics, where you get clear yes-no answers to most questions. If you say, can a particle travel faster than light? The answer is no. But in biology generally, and cancer in particular, there's many shades of grey.
What about stem cell research? What about the modification of one's genetic code?
So stem cells are very interesting, and this, and in a way, point the fundamental problem about tackling cancer, because cancer cells, in reverting to a sort of ancestral phenotype, going back, becoming a throwback to a simpler past, a sort of reprimitivization, they're becoming more and more stem-like. They are de-differentiating. So stem cells, I don't know if our listeners are aware of this, but stem cells are still cells whose fate is yet to be determined. They can become liver cells and kidney cells and skin cells and so on. But they all have the same DNA. Every cell in our body has the same DNA, but the different genes get expressed in the different tissues. So stem cells are sort of still have the potential to develop into many different cells. Cancer is a bit like going backwards. It de-differentiates, goes back to a more stem-like state. So the problem is, whatever you develop to tackle cancer, if you want to zap the cancer cells, there's a good chance you're going to zap the stem cells at the same time. And this is the bugbear of treating cancer. How do you treat the cancer and not kill the patient as part of the process?
When you and I first met over 30 years ago, I would remind you, you were a refugee from Thatcher's Britain. You then found a sort of political asylum in Australia, and you're now ensconced in Arizona.
Right.
Has America been kind to you? In other words, is it now your home mentally?
So Arizona State University is a stupendous institution. I've never worked anywhere like it. And part of the reason for that, well, the main reason is that the president is a true visionary. So he's not just a leader of a university intent on doing a bit more of the same. He really wants to fundamentally shake things up. And most universities are the other way around. It's the young people at the bottom where all the energy and revolution comes from. And as you get further and further up the system, you're given all sorts of reasons why it can't happen.
So did he recruit you?
Yes. So he has been instrumental in trying to create a university structure where subject boundaries don't matter, where people can just follow their inclinations across whatever it takes. And so he's created all sorts of new structures. We have an Institute of Biodesign, a School of Sustainability, a School of Earth and Space Exploration. All of these new categories are unusual for universities, but provide a very fertile and exciting environment for this sort of research.
It has to happen. Long before I met you, I had a chore conducting a seminar at CSIRO in its golden era. And what I discovered in the course of the day were that scientists who worked in adjacent labs were only dimly aware of what their colleagues were doing. It was a shock to me that there wasn't this interaction between disciplines.
Yes, and I think if ever you want a bad example of that, it is cancer research. People are so specialized. This is a field of research it has to be said, that is so well-resourced in terms of the amount of money, $5 billion a year of taxpayer money just in the United States. So that's leaving out the charities and the other government departments, just the NCI budget. So well-resourced that inevitably people get into their own tiny little rut and they keep doing the same thing because there's funding to do it, and they don't talk to their colleagues. And part of the reason they wanted to set up these centres for physical science and cancer biology, bringing in people from outside, was to bang a few heads together and get people talking.
Okay, I want you to tackle another area now, and that's climate change.
Right.
I'd like you to sort that out, and we'll have a chat about that in a couple of weeks. Paul Davies is an astrophysicist, and among many things, he's the head of the Centre for Convergence of Physical Science and Cancer Biology. That's a wrap from our little wireless program. On our next, we'll hear how refrigeration changed our lives. It'll be of some interest to you, Paul. You probably never thought about that. LNL, stick around now for the news.